Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Starting right out of the box with an announcement, they're here, at least at Safeway. So I got my 25-26 COVID vaccine today, and I just want to let everyone know that I was able to make a same-day reservation. I imagine those are going to dry up, so I urge anyone, I urge everyone, really, to go ahead and get your vaccine, get your appointment, get that set up and ready. I am still not clear how many batches or whether we're going to hit a crunch in the supply. I don't know, and goodness knows things are so much in flux on the matter of vaccines, there's literally no way to tell. Let's start with an interesting bit of information. I'll be getting back to you with more geeky biochemistry about this maybe next week, but an association between metformin use and disease progression in obese people with osteoarthritis. Now, this data is not what it sounds like. You title it like that, it sounds like metformin is actually causing more rapid disease progression. That's because our brains go in that direction, of course, when we see a scientific article. But actually, it's quite the opposite. This study was designed to see whether the volume of knee cartilage over 4 years and the risk of total knee replacement over 6 years in overweight people with knee arthritis would be better with the use of metformin. Now, why obese people only? Well, simply because given the constraints of doing a study, which is to say 4 years and 6 years, you want to be sure that you pick a high-risk group so that the control group and the metformin group diverge within the amount of time. Non-users of metformin, this was a four-year follow-up. Nobody had used it. They looked at medial and lateral cartilage volume using MRI, which is very accurate, and of course, total knee replacement. You just do a chart survey. And they found something really interesting. The medial cartilage, that's the one that usually goes first, particularly in women. The loss was lower in metformin users compared with non-users, 0.75% versus 1.5%. So you're talking about half the amount of cartilage being lost, and that was significant to a level of 0.02, which for a population study that's so short, pretty good evidence. It was also associated with a trend towards reduction in risk of total knee replacement over those 6 years. That odds ratio was 0.3, meaning that twice as many people had, so two-thirds of a reduction, if you will, or twice as many people ended up with knee replacements, depending upon how you want to slice and dice the language around the number. So what could be going on here? The thought is that it has to do with AMPK, which is a protein kinase, and we're going to get into just a little bit of detail. What they found was that metformin has a lot of effects that affect lipids. It's also being shown to maybe have some benefit for brain function and as an anti-aging agent. And so when we look at what's going on here, it's a complicated thing, but I'm just going to give you the brief version of it. If the body is low in energy, and this, of course, could be from fasting, this could be from exhausting exercise, it could be from a lot of things, but then you're going to have a lot of, instead of ATP, you're going to have a lot of AMP. ATP is triphosphate, adenosine triphosphate, and AMP is adenosine monophosphate. And cyclic AMP, which is another thing, it's just looped in a circle, actually is a neurotransmitter, interestingly enough, but we're talking about just plain old AMP. And it fits in to this AMPK receptor, And what it does is it has multiple different effects, but the effect is to shut down any process that uses up calories, energy, for example, storing calories in the form of fat. So it reduces cholesterol. It reduces the production of triglycerides. You're not going to store your fat now. You're going to leave it available to be burned. On the other hand, if you have high levels of ATP sitting in the same place in this receptor, you're going to start storing energy as fat. So it sort of makes sense that this would be an important control factor. What isn't immediately clear is the inflammatory effects, and I'm going to dive down a bit deeper into those because I think that might be what's associated with some of the statistical evidence, which has been hard to establish in humans, but it's well established in animal models, that the presence of metformin actually slows aging and reduces the diseases of aging in animals. Now we got to figure out if it works in humans. One study, however, getting back to our knee arthritis topic, one study showed that people who mixed metformin with COX-2 inhibitors, that would be drugs like Celebrex, reduced the risk of joint replacement by 25% over 10 years compared to people who just used those COX-2 inhibitors alone. Ibuprofen would be considered a COX-2 inhibitor. All of the NSAIDs are, but the study I'm talking about used Celebrex, which is an exclusive COX-2 inhibitor, or at least mostly a COX-2 inhibitor. What's COX-2? Well, that's the thing that makes prostaglandins. And prostaglandins are mostly primarily inflammatory compounds, although there are some that are protective. Weight loss is not a factor here in the beneficial effect of metformin. So that's not the sole mechanism, although sometimes it does help with weight loss. Another benefit may be in the reduction of inflammation. We see that there might be some improved glucose and cholesterol levels, both of which make inflammation very important to the long-term survival of the organism. So can we establish that metformin is helpful for people with knee arthritis? Yeah, I think we can count on that. And low doses, say 500 milligrams a day, have markedly few side effects on individuals. In fact, if you tend towards constipation, they may, in fact, at that dose, be valuable. So a little bit of helpful news for you. And let's move on to kind of a fun one about blue pigs and blue pig meat. Not pygmies, pig meat. So wild pigs are often will eat rodent bait, basically rat poison, that are put out in these areas that are sort of in the country. We're talking particularly about this going on in Monterey County. There's a warning where they found this particular rodent side called diphasinone. And it's getting into, it's there to kill the rodents, right? But it doesn't stop the pigs from eating the bait. And it works by inhibiting the production of blood clotting factors related to vitamin K. So it is working exactly the way that the coumarin drugs like warfarin are doing. But you will see when you slaughter the animal or look at the meat, a blue tint to the pig's tissues. They don't always get sick, so they can be looking pretty good, these pigs. And cooking doesn't help to reduce the residue. So meat from feral pigs in areas with active rodent control programs should be avoided. Now, here's the thing, folks, and why am I even talking about this? Because it's wild pig season, and whether you're a hunter or not, from from now, September, to the end of November, there are going to be possibly people offering you meat from their kills if you have friends who are hunters. You'll want to look carefully at that meat. And I would say avoid wild pig meat anyway, but I know that there are many people who kind of are into it. And I just want to make sure that you know that there is a substantial risk locally. In the department called Using a Shotgun When You Need a Scalpel, we're going to recap an editorial that occurred in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of months ago. And I've just been, I don't always like to climb on my soapbox every show, so I've been saving this one, but I have no other soapboxes at the moment. So 64 years ago, Eunice Kennedy Shriver went sailing with her brother, then President John F. Kennedy, on the Nantucket Sound. During the trip, Shriver suggested to her brother that his wife Jacqueline's recent pregnancy losses might have been caused by underlying medical issues. Shriver, a compassionate humanitarian who pursued a platform of social reform and social justice, is often remembered as founding the Special Olympics and also a dedicated advocate for people with disabilities. But she left another important legacy. She convinced the President of the United States to support the creation of a federal institute devoted to the areas of women and children's health. Shriver's vision lives on in the work of her namesake institution, the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Actions by the Trump administration have placed in grave jeopardy the future of women's health, a central focus of that research funded by NICHD. The term women's health refers not only to conditions that are specific to women, but also to health issues that disproportionately affect women and those that affect women differently than men. This institute, founded in 1962, was the first to focus on health throughout the lifespan rather than on a specific condition. It's funded thousands of studies on a wide range of topics: Parkinson's, preterm birth, prevention of medical errors in neonatal ICUs, septic shock, cigarette smoking, postpartum depression, safe infant sleep. Think how many lives, and think how many men have been benefited by that. Now, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death among men in the United States, and we never studied women. We never really noticed that women have different symptoms for heart disease until people actually looked at heart disease in women. Research on the ovary has created strategies for extending healthy lifespans for all sexes, and reducing maternal mortality has saved more lives of both males and females than can even be counted, because you can't really assess how many things didn't happen. Women are also they're half the U.S. workforce, and they also, on top of that, serve as the main unpaid caregivers for children and family members. It's been 20 years since the NIH Revitalization Act mandated that women be included in clinical trials. Prior to that, the majority of studies did not even look at it. Even now, the majority of studies do not report sex-specific results. And only 3% of NIH's budget is allocated. More women are more likely to die of a heart attack, and that's partly because they get missed. Women have greatly higher numbers of adverse drug reactions than men, and they have more severe, frequent, and persistent symptoms associated with chronic pain due to the fact that they have two X chromosomes, and that affects the way that their pain receptors work. They tend to have more of them, just as simple as that. In the name of agency priorities, government agencies have been directed by the federal government to scour grants and grants proposals for terms related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Unfortunately, the words women and female are on this list where the words male are not. That's resulted in $2.5 billion in research funding being rescinded. Much of this research was directed at women's health, which we are behind in studying. There is a knowledge deficit. This crippling of biomedical research needs to be reversed. To the extent that you are able to express your opinion on the matter to your representatives, we need to get a bill supported by women from both sides of the political spectrum. When women unite together for their own interests and the interests of children, they can do miracles. So let's get a move on, folks, because this has to be turned around. Our next story is brown rice healthier or less healthy than white rice? And this came from a question that one of my patients asked me when I was taking a diet history. Brown rice has more fiber, and it's because it contains the hull. There's a great deal more thiamine and some of the other B vitamins. Fiber-rich foods are known to lower the risk of developing heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and some cancers. But what about arsenic? Rice is grown in, well, ankle-deep water. And so there's an awful lot of evaporation going on, and a lot of arsenic gets absorbed by the rice. For most U.S. adults, you would have to eat way more than the average amount. You would have to eat excessive amounts of rice to develop health problems. Although, of course, some people do eat 2 or 3 cups of rice a day, and that is probably getting into the level where you might be getting excessive. But infants and toddlers are much more vulnerable to the harmful effects of rice. There's things you can do, and one of them is to use different types of grains. Why is there arsenic in rice in the first place? Both types of rice have arsenic. As I've said, it is a problem because of the prolonged water bath that the roots are sitting in. There is arsenic in the ground anyway, and it becomes soluble with that prolonged water, and the plant's roots basically absorb the arsenic thinking it's a nutrient. Brown rice is converted. It all starts out as brown rice. It's converted to white rice by stripping off its surface, and it ends up containing about half as much arsenic as brown rice. This is substantial when you're talking about, say, making infants eat rice cereal every day. One recent study in Michigan State looked at average levels of arsenic, inorganic arsenic, in white and brown rice. They found about 138 parts per billion in brown rice and 93 in white rice, so about one-third less. We've got to put that in perspective. The World Health Organization says any brown rice should not have more than 350 parts per billion, so we're at less than half of that. The Food and Drug Administration says bottled water should have no more than 10 parts per billion, and rice cereal for infants no more than 100 parts per billion. Children are especially vulnerable because they're developing. Their organs are growing. Their brains are growing. And it's important to provide a more diverse diet. We've always traditionally said start with rice cereal, but the American Pediatrics Association has changed its tune on that. They say mashed or pureed avocado, bananas, butternut squash, sweet potatoes, beans, or lentils are fine as a first food for children. And giving them a variety of other grains like oats, cooked barley, quinoa, farro, have a lot less arsenic than rice because they don't have that prolonged water bath dissolving all the arsenic in the soil. The other thing the Academy says is avoid rice milk in children and don't use processed toddler foods that use rice syrup, because rice syrup, of course, that's concentrated rice. If you're just wanting to have your brown rice and eat it too, soak it for 30 minutes and then rinse thoroughly. Instead of using a rice cooker, use a pot of boiling water and do a 4-to-1 ratio of water to rice, and then strain the rice and get rid of the water. So don't go ahead and use a rice cooker and boil down all the water, because that is not going to help you get rid of the arsenic that was there. Parboiling is another strategy. Not clear to me why it works, but parboiling is essentially boiling the rice in a very small amount of water for 5 minutes and then move to a fresh pot of water. And that cut the arsenic levels by half for brown rice and more than two-thirds for white rice. So interesting little chemical trick there. And I am just going to encourage you to eat a wide variety of foods. I remember a story that I read in the Townsend Letter, must have been 10 years ago, when everyone went crazy for kale. And it was quite the thing to have a kale shake, might even be 15 years ago. And suddenly everybody was doing that. Now, one person noticed, because they do a lot of heavy metal studies and check their patients' urines for heavy metals, they were, you know, they're looking for lead and mercury. But when they got the reports back, they were also seeing high levels, like real substantially high levels of cadmium, which in the environment is found mostly in paint. And so oil painters who lick their brushes can show up with high levels of cadmium, but it's otherwise wasn't a thing. And it turns out that kale is just really excellent at concentrated cadmium. So where there is cadmium in the soil, all of these metals are present in the soil, but they're present in small enough amounts that they're not toxic. Once they're bioconcentrated, however, whether that's by kale or by tuna in the ocean, you start to get to levels that actually have toxicity. So really kind of interesting details there. I hope you'll agree. All right, we have a caller on the line. Caller, I'm going to put you right on. Welcome to the show. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
My name's David, and I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
What's your question?
Lately, I've been talking with my doctor about oxidative stress and reductive stress, and whether or not to use a glutathione product called Continual G, which is actually gets into the cells and bypasses the liver. Have you heard anything about this?
Oh, I'm very familiar with glutathione products. Not that particular product. Is it by any chance a liposomal product?
No, actually, this is different than liposomal. It, it's like the precursor for building glutathione. And once it gets into the system, then the rest of the construction evidently happens, and it gets it to the cell level, because evidently most glutathione doesn't even get past the liver.
Well, a question I would have for you, is this by any chance N-acetylcysteine? Because that's the precursor to glutathione I'm familiar with. So it's probably either that or
an
intermediate.
Now.
Well, could be an intermediate, because there's several steps.
Well, let me see here. I think, I don't know if I can pronounce it correctly, but I have it written down. It's gamma glutamyl cysteine.
Yeah, so that's gamma glutamyl cysteine. See, why the cysteine is a amino acid that contains a lot of sulfur. In order to get that amino acid, which has an acidic charge on it, you have to turn it into a salt, not a salt with two S's, a salt. And so you could use the N-acetyl, or you could use the gamma-glutamyl, but both of these serve the same purpose of allowing you to create something that will be absorbed. So this makes sense to me. Things can't, with a charge can't get into cells, so you have to blunt or hide the charge. So it's a different molecule. It may, or I don't know the biochemistry at this level, it may or may not have superior properties to the one, the N-acetyl, but it's jumping right into the same pathway in order to build the glutathione. And this is an intracellular pathway. As far as most of the glutathione getting sucked up by the liver, that's probably true, but most of the glutathione definitely does not get into the bloodstream. If it's in a liposomal form, it can cross into the lymphatics rather than getting into the portal vein, which is the vein that drains the gut and it goes right through the liver, and everything the liver wants to take out, it takes out. So this is a legitimate legitimate approach to getting glutathione into the cells. It is a precursor, but it should work, theoretically at least.
Yeah, have you heard of reductive stress as compared to oxidative stress?
Yes, and reductive stress is when you actually have too much antioxidants or reductants, right? So reductants is the same as antioxidants. So people who overdose on antioxidants may be inadvertently, so to speak, shooting themselves in the foot, because we need oxidative bursts to turn on cellular processes. And for example, growth and oxidative stress is necessary for the killing that the NK, the natural killer cells, do for against cancers. So you can make the argument that too much antioxidants of the wrong kind could theoretically interfere with cancer. And of course, the chemotherapy people are very worried about this and will advise people who have cancer not to use any concentrated antioxidants. It's a bit more nuanced than that, really. There are plenty of studies that show that certain antioxidants, for example, green tea extract, can actually help with the killing, the oxidant effect of chemotherapy. It's a case-by-case basis, and that's too complicated to keep in your head. So I don't blame the oncologist for saying, okay, no antioxidants. I do blame them for not listening when someone gives them a paper that's, you know, scientific, legitimate, you know, good control group, etc., that shows, in fact, that there's benefit. But you know, getting people to change their minds on the basis of a couple papers is very hard. Getting more than a couple of papers to make a persuasive argument, that's even harder. What is your question about this? Okay, we've established that I've heard of these things.
Yeah, a few years ago or so, I've had a chronic inflammation situation for a long time. And I did a hair analysis. I don't know how reliable they are, but it seems fairly reliable because it came up with a lot of things like high mercury and high aluminum. But one of the things it came up with was very high oxidative stress.
Right.
And so I tried a few things like urolithin A and NAD, and they just, I crashed completely worse than I was before. Like I was, you know, it didn't accept, my friends were doing it, and they were having a great boost out of it, and I went the opposite direction. So I thought, oh well, this isn't what the symptoms indicate. And then, you know, later on, over a year later, I looked at the reductive stress, and if I was putting those things into my system and I had reductive stress, it would make sense why I would crash.
You kind of lost me there. But what's the question? I mean,
question is, if you try to use a supplement, let's say like NAD, and you have oxidative stress, and it doesn't seem to increase or repair or whatever the inflammation, what would you recommend, or what would be a better choice than?
Okay. So first of all, I suspect that you have some genetic variants that are unusual, and this may account for why things that your friends found helpful, they didn't work for you. Secondly, I think you are working off of a false premise, which is to say you expect that that fighting the oxidative stress will make you feel better, or that you will in fact notice that. The markers that we use for oxidative stress are things like damaged fat molecules, right? So if there's oxidation of the fat, then we consider that would be the cell wall. That would be a marker for oxidative stress. Another mark we use is something called 8-ODG, which is one of the nucleic acids that make up DNA gets damaged, and that DNA gets broken down, and this damaged molecule is in the blood and in the urine, so we can measure it. And those are the two oxidative stress markers that are typically used in functional medicine. And, you know, if you get a panel or something, that's what you're going to see. And then they will typically recommend antioxidants. And that's sort of, again, you can overdo your antioxidants. I think that you have to be careful in expecting something you can feel. I think if you measure those markers for oxidative stress after taking action, particularly with the lipooxygenase, you probably will see something fairly quickly, like a month, just to give you a pattern.
Okay.
And you may not feel any better, because there's a lot going on that can just be self-perpetuating. It's like saying, yeah, I stopped throwing matches out of my car. Why is there still a fire? And, you know, as you know, once forest fires get going, they make their own wind. And there's a certain amount of that going on with our biological processes. So it isn't as simple as just, oh, you know, oxidative stress is like throwing water on a fire. It's much more complicated. And I suspect, as I said, there may be genetic variations, unique ones that you have, that are getting in your way. So you're just going to have to get evidence each time you try something. And if it makes you feel bad, then don't do it. Don't take it. I mean, that's a no-brainer, right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting, because this reductive stress, oxidative stress interaction was a new concept to my primary, and he's having to do a lot of homework right now because of it.
There's a lot out there in the literature about it, but I think that it's, in principle, redox and oxidation reduction is one of the hardest concepts to keep in your head medically as a doctor. And I mean, you learn it, and it just doesn't really make sense, and you walk through it, and you just have to keep reminding yourself what the heck you're talking about and go look it up. So I sympathize. It's always embarrassing to the ego but I'm glad that I want to compliment your doctor. The fact that he's going to go study up on it is the best indicator that you've got there a doctor who's intellectually honest and interested in the science and the physiology. So go him. And go
well,
you.
Thank you for your advice. And it is, you're right, having a curious doctor is really important these days. Most of them don't want to give you more than 15 minutes.
Indeed. They can't. Otherwise, they're going to be stuck at their desk until 10:30 at night doing their notes. We're trapped on this hamster wheel of the electronic medical record. We shouldn't have to be doing the billing. And what we're effectively doing is we're justifying up billing on the part of our corporate masters. So they want all of these, all of this detail, because that's what Medicare and other agencies demand. And it's a complete waste of time. Just pay us a salary and charge the patients. And, maybe the government can stop assuming that everybody is a fraudulent actor. That would be a good first step, but I'm not going to hold my breath. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right. We have another caller on. All right. And tell me your name and what's your question?
Carrie. This is Carrie in SoCal.
Hello, Carrie in SoCal.
I would love to have you talk a bit about histamine. Like, I'm tracking down food allergies right now, and I came across some really interesting things last night about histamine reactions, because it matches my symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a list of the foods I've cut out already.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to learn more about histamine reactions in foods that I am allergic to.
Okay. Well, let's start out with histamine intolerance. And so there's a couple of different reasons people can have that. But basically, histamine is a neurotransmitter. It is a chemical signal. It's supposed to be broken down in the body when it's released. It's released to cause a protective reaction, but once that reaction is going, you have to damp it down the reaction, because otherwise it becomes a self-perpetuating loop, as I was saying with the previous caller. So the gastrointestinal symptoms are the ones that usually bring people to the doctor, and bloating, abdominal pain, diarrhea, and also sometimes constipation, nausea, vomiting in advanced cases. But people can also get dizzy. They can drop their blood pressure. They can have palpitations. They can get flushing of their face. They can get itching, joint pain. I mean, it can even affect the menstrual periods. Some people will find that they'll get it from alcohol, for example. And there are many foods that are rich in histamine. Basically, anything fermented. So all those good lacto-fermented foods, like sauerkraut and that we're telling you to eat, they have higher levels of histamine. A lot of the charcuterie, the aged meats, aged cheese, and fruits and vegetables, when they get older and riper, may have fairly high levels of histamine. And furthermore, not just to make it fun, histidine is an amino acid that is present in protein. And if you have certain bacteria in your gut, you're going to convert histidine into histamine. And then we've really got stuff. We've got weird stuff causing reactions that can be very difficult to track down.
Yeah.
And then our previous caller, I mentioned, I thought he might have genetic variations. There are two really important enzymes that break down histamine. And one of them is called DAO, which is diamine oxidase, and that's the one that's made in the gut, in the intestine, because this thing with the bacteria making histamine, that's been around for a while. And so we've got, going back to way before there were mammals, this particular enzyme that's designed to help deal with the gut bacteria of literally the gut bacteria at the dinosaur level. So it's an old enzyme, and some people don't make it. They have a genetic loss, and if the gut gets sick, it makes less of it. And some people take it as a supplement, the way you might take lactase. If you have lactose intolerance, you'll take the enzyme that breaks down milk. You can purchase DAO, although it's been a little thin on the ground and hard to find, at least on the internet, the last few years, and I'm not quite sure why. The thing that there's also an N-methylhistaminase, which takes histamine and throws a methyl group on it. I think it's N-methylhistamine transferase, if I'm remembering its name right. But essentially, it defangs the histamine that gets into your bloodstream, which is released by your allergy cells in large quantities when you're having an allergic reaction. So that is a complicated question you just asked me, and I just have given you the background. But why don't you give me like a specific for instance so that I can actually provide you with more than information and maybe something you can use?
Sure, and I'll just tell you where I'm at. My eyes are puffy every morning, but I'm also, I had several things going on. One, I had blepharitis, got over that. I have seborrheic dermatitis, and I know how to take care of that. In the meantime, there's two things I've started recently. I'm kind of changing gears here. The two things that I've recently started that I fell in love with are chai in the morning and a brisket, beef brisket, smoked beef brisket. Mm-hmm. And so, so I have those two on my list. Those are first on my list to cut out and see what happens. And then the others are some of the vegetables and fruits that were listed in the videos I was watching. So, you know, I'm doing the process of elimination for what I'm allergic to, because, you know, my eyes are so swollen that sometimes if they got any more swollen in the mornings, and they go down after I do hot and cold compresses and I do a few things, and then I can have some normal time during the day, and then it will start again by midnight. My eyes feel real itchy and puffy, and the blepharitis left the skin around my eyes. So everything I had to take for that irritated the skin around my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that I really can't tell, Dr. Don, between getting over that, getting that out of the way, and that subsiding, and going this other route I think I'm allergic to a few things.
You may very well be, and so the other thing that you could have is you could have eyelid mites, MITES.
Oh, I know. That's what I got over.
Ah, okay.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
How do you know you're over them?
Well, because I go to my eye doctor every other week, and we kind of monitor.
Okay, all right. So I'm going to. I believe your eye doctor knows what they're doing. So
yeah.
We're going to say you're cured. Your eye doctor can also give you something that is it's not an antihistamine, although that maybe wouldn't be a bad idea either.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an antihistamine release agent. The histamine, as I've indicated, doesn't just float around. It has to be released by the cells who are the guardians of histamine. And they dole it out when they're stimulated by the allergen. So if there is a compound, a molecule that's triggering the histamine release, this will work by raising the threshold for the histamine release. So you won't get as much histamine released, because not as many cells will reach their threshold, so you won't dump as much into your eye, so some of the swelling and the redness should go down if it's histamine-related. Now, so the chromalin, the antihistamines work by blocking the histamine receptor, which is fine, but using the chromalin, I think, will tell us if histamine is, in fact, the issue. And it does require 3 or 4 days of use before you start to notice benefit. But I think that would be a really good strategy. It's available as a generic. It's, you know, it requires, it drops after you put in about 4 times a day. You'll do that. You're motivated.
Oh, yes, I will.
So that won't be a problem. You don't wear eye makeup, right? And so I just want to rule out the possibility that you're allergic to, you know, your eyeliner or something. I had some eyeliner, this must be, 40 years ago, and it had formaldehyde in it when I looked at the ingredients. And I'm like, formaldehyde? I got sensitized to formaldehyde when I was cutting up bodies back at Davis, and I would get terrible. In fact, my soft contact lenses hardened and cross-linked and fell out of my eyeballs, and it was like the formaldehyde was so thick in that room it ate my contact lenses. That's crazy.
Yeah, but is the chromalin, is that the antihistamine release thing?
Yes,
that's the name of it. Okay,
yeah, it's chromalin sodium, and one of the brands is OptiChrome, and it's.
Optichrome,
and it's without the H, so it's C-R-O-M.
C-R-O-M. Okay, I will, and some of it, I can get it over the counter as well.
I think is still prescription, but the eye antihistamines are over the counter.
Okay.
And
thank you.
You could use both and really just try to hit the histamine. Also, don't use fabric softener.
Yeah, I don't use...
Good. Don't use fabric softener because it can irritate the eyelids. And
okay, yeah, not a factor.
And my British boyfriend many years ago used to call the naughty bits. And I can't tell you how many women have come in with a rash on their privates, and I've said no fabric softener, and they've called me a week later thank me profusely because they've been, you know, they've taken all this other stuff that hasn't touched it. It's just like, oh, okay, fabric softener. Who knew? Especially the dryer sheets. Those are the other one that can do it.
So anyway, this is my start, is to eliminate the two things that I've really been overdosing on, and that would be the dry.
Do you make brisket is a fermented food, or it can be, depending on how it's made.
This is smoked.
So,
and it's really good.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't really know that smoking would do the same thing biochemically. You've come to the edge of my knowledge cliff.
Yeah. They talked about smoked meat, so wow, I really hate to give that up. But anyway, I'm doing an experimental period.
I think that's a very good idea. And because histamine doesn't hang around that long, probably a week or so is long enough for you to see the benefits.
Okay, and thank you so much for
You're welcome. Thank you for the interesting question. I really appreciate it. All right.
Appreciate having you to ask. Thank you, Dr. Dunn.
You have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, let's just try to end up with a real quick one. This is good. Your face reveals a lot about your health. A new AI tool can pinpoint your biological age from a selfie. You know, we look at people and say, because age is consistent with, appears to be consistent with stated age, younger or older than stated age. A cancer patient might look 72, but they're really 65. This new tool is called Face Age. They train the algorithm on 60,000 photographs of people 60 or older. And they looked at 6,000 cancer patients getting therapy. And they found that the older that face age saw them, the lower their survival rate. They then asked 8 doctors to predict which terminal cancer patients would be alive in 6 months. Well, working off a photo, the doctors were right 61% of the time. Face age was 80% with no data except that face. So this could really be useful medically because we could, depending upon, well, first of all, we need to study it and see how long it takes for things to change, just like with our last caller. How long does it take to get better? Well, then we'd check again to make sure we're on the right track. Our fellow who was asking about reductive stress versus oxidative stress, again, let's face age him, do our intervention, and see if that face improves. Such an interesting thing. Possibly a tool for psychology as well. AI is definitely a double-edged sword. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.